So in the cultivation of compassion, it's said to be a natural movement of the heart in recognition of suffering. So the practice we were doing with metta of opening our heart to a sense of kindness towards others, it's only a slight shift, actually, if you tune into the fact that for most of us there is actually some suffering going on. And in recognizing that suffering, then allowing the heart to open to a natural sense of connection with that, of caring with that. The reason that in this first practice I was recommending not to pick someone who's too close to you or who's in too much suffering is because some of the areas that we can slide off into a different state is in going into grief. So either if the person is very close to us and so we're very attached to the outcome or feel like we really want to change it and we can't, there sometimes can be a sense of grief and despair. So that's different than sense of direct compassion. Also different is a sense of pity. As I mentioned yesterday, that's like one of the near enemies of compassion is pity. So with pity, there's a sense of separation from the other. And it's like, oh, you're down there and I'm up here and I feel sorry for you. You know? Whereas compassion is actually together, you know, connected. So not feeling better than or in some way separate from the one who is suffering. So there can be, you know, different flavors of the experience of compassion, ranging from a slight sense of warmth to a very deep sense of deep bottomless compassion. And like with the metta, with when we're doing the practice of cultivating this, your job as a practitioner really is just to try to connect with that subject, try to connect with that phrase, that intention of compassion, and then really not to worry, like whether it's a sense of explosive compassion or little compassion or even nothing at all. You know, so just to continue to come back and plant those seeds of inclining the heart in that direction of compassion. So it's helpful to recognize that it's really a natural human tendency to be able to do this. And you might reflect on having seen this, even even among very small children sometimes you can see this. Like for some kids it's a common thing, like they see someone with a band-aid at a certain stage and they're like, poo-poo, right? You know, they're really like, oh, you know. They recognize like, oh, I know that that means someone who got hurt, like that's difficult, you know. You know, so they want to go and help. You know, someone's struggling with something, they want to go and help in some way. You know, whether or not they can help, they want to help. So it's like that motivation, that natural movement of the heart is like a sense of compassion. Right? So we all have that in us at different times. You know, and it's sort of in some ways clearing away the other stuff that covers up that natural tendency that we have, that natural reaction. So in some of the Buddhist traditions, compassion is actually featured even more strongly than metta. In this tradition, the Theravada tradition, metta is usually the kind of main one, but compassion is an equally useful one to cultivate. It's said also to be a counter to a sense of cruelty. Metta is a counter to a sense of aversion or hatred, and compassion is developing compassion counters any sense of cruelty, you know, the enjoyment of suffering. So it's shifting the mind towards this other more wholesome relationship to what might be happening. So when you tune in this way in the world, you can actually just see suffering in many different forms. So on the drive here, I was just paying attention a little bit with this lens and could see, you know, someone crossing the street. There's an older guy crossing the street with a cane, and he was like hurrying to try and get across before the light changed. And it was like, oh yeah, that's difficult. You know, it's difficult not to be able to walk so easily without the cane, and it's difficult to feel the stress of the traffic light changing, right? And we passed a butcher shop, so could see from that, like, oh yeah, the animals who are killed in this way, you know, there's suffering involved in that industry, certainly, pain of that. And we passed a place that was like a I don't know if it was like a strip club or a peep show or something, but like it was on the water, but there's no windows, so it's like could have had a nice view, but did not have a nice view, you know. And it's like, oh, that must be a difficult place to be employed in there, you know, like there's suffering and just that's not a great employment situation to have to be in there, this windowless thing, you know, doing this kind of work. So. And then seeing, just animals struggling for existence even, you know, birds. Like if you actually tune in, you know, sometimes you can see the beauty and the joy, which is also true, but sometimes you can see the struggle for existence that's there. Like the struggle to find food, or the struggle to fight off predators, the struggle to find safety, you know. So it's actually not hard when you tune into this to see that for all of us as living beings, there is difficulty in our lives, just from the conditions of the world, of having to keep things a certain temperature to feel comfortable and healthy, you know, of needing to constantly be feeding ourselves and drinking in order to keep the body alive, you know, in needing a certain amount of sense of love or a certain amount of shelter or money, or, you know, there's a lot of different stresses that all of us face in some way or another, which weigh more heavily at different times on different of us. Or here's with the understanding of the Dharma, the truth of the way things are, can also support this, you know, just recognizing that for all of us, we cannot escape from getting older, right, from the body changing in ways that we may or may not like it to, from the possibility of getting sick, and inevitably from the possibility of death. You know. So Buddha encouraged us that it actually is helpful to reflect on this. You know, all that which I love, all that which is dear to me, from this I will surely be departed in some way, sooner or later, either through my departure, from the departure of those beings, from the objects that I find dear, from their breaking, disintegration, loss. Right? So there's a poignancy to this in this world of impermanence, that there's nowhere to land. So it's holding a sense of compassion for all of us in this, you know, whoever we are. And you can't escape, you know, none of us can escape from this. So it does require a certain openness of heart, you know, to tune into this. It can require a slowing down from our usual goal-oriented, busy way of doing things. You know. A shift from people as objects or tools for us to get something done. You know. Or like you're describing, even in the grocery line, you know, you could have a sense of metta for people, but also if you tune into the suffering of everyone, who probably also was like, oh, I can't believe the line's so long. I can't believe there's only one cashier today. You know, it's like, oh, yeah, suffering. may we all be free from suffering. Yeah. May we all be free from impatience or difficulty or anxiety or, you know. So it's a good shift, and it's kind of like the shift when I was describing yesterday, that sign that's like, if you're stuck in traffic, like, oh, you're not stuck in traffic, like, you are actually traffic, you know, to everyone around you, right? So it can shift from that impatience and everyone else is in my way to like, oh, look. In some ways it's like, oh, this is like, with traffic I think it's like the flow of some river, you know, that has different, in different parts it goes different speeds, and it's probably like this here. In the Bay Area it seems like on the highways there's certain areas that always get slow. And sometimes it's not even clear why, what all the causes are, but it's like always for some reason that. But it's just like a river in which like, oh, in this bend the water starts to run slow and then goes faster, and you know, so when you happen to be stuck in that bend, it's like, oh, okay, I could get impatient and mad at everyone, or I can feel like, oh, look, we're all stuck in this together in some way. So that sense of connection, like, oh, may we be free from suffering in this, right? So sometimes you can perceive yourself to be part of it, or sometimes it may be just more obvious, like, oh yeah, that person is injured, or that, you know. So there's some relating that happens on the level of like our shared humanity, you know, our shared sense of this. So it also requires some connection to your own vulnerability, your own lack of omnipotence, you know, in order to access that in some way. But there's also a strength, you know, with all these states. I think sometimes people think like, oh, it's a weak state to have love or compassion, but it actually is a place of strength to be able to rest in that, to see what's actually true. You know? And the motivation that comes from a state of compassion can be very pure. It can be very strong also. It can be very fierce action that comes from connection to compassion. So that's what we'll spend our morning working with, kind of exploring, is the state of compassion. What it is, how to cultivate it, what it is not. As we go along, also you might meet the near enemies of it a little bit. Sometimes you might find yourself in states of indifference or lack of connection. And that's all okay. It's all kind of learning the landscape of the heart, you know, starting to notice, like, what is that, what is not that, and so on. Right? So this is our continuation of mind and heart training this way around compassion. So let me pause and see if there's any questions about that, and we'll do some walking practice with it. Yeah, the being overwhelmed by the amount of pain and suffering. Yeah, so in that one, the sense of the equanimity, which is the fourth of the Brahmaviharas, helps, which is recognizing that it's not all in our control, too. So, you know, things are as they are. You know, so it's like, okay, what is your options? If it's true, there is like a huge amount of suffering in the world. There also is a lot of joy in the world, too. So it's helpful to kind of balance out seeing that, too. But then our choices, given that there's a lot of suffering, is like, okay, I could tune out from it then, which maybe is like what our usual state of being is like actually not to connect with it because it's hard to connect with it, right? Or in deepening this sense of the compassion, like the more that we connect with that sense of suffering, actually the deeper that compassion could be. So I'd say notice that sense of despair as that sort of the grief despair. So that's a veering off from the direct experience of suffering. And usually when there's a veering off in some way, with all of these Brahmaviharas, is when there might be like some sense of self arising with it. So check it out and see. But like with pity, it's like, oh, here's me and here's you down here. Or with grief, sometimes there can be a like, oh, what can I do about it? You know, like, how can I help this? Or even a sense of like wanting to fix it, wanting to control it, or something like that. And it's very subtle because compassion does care about it and might do something about it, but it's from a different sense than like a sense of me in there, if that makes sense. Yeah. But it's understandable, and it's a common thing that might come up, a sense of grief or overwhelm or despair, right? So if, like with the other practices, if it comes up briefly, then you could just let go of it. If it comes up strongly, then you could shift your attention to that as grief, like use the Vipassana practice to attend to that, feel it, move through that energy, and then come back again. But even the recognition, like, okay, this is grief, and that's different than compassion, is helpful distinction too. Also, you can kind of titrate with what is the object that you're working with, you know. So sometimes we tend to have more grief or despair if it is, you know, if we've opened to a huge thing, like if we're facing like war or, you know, something very large. So then actually reel it back into one thing, you know, this person in front of me who is limping, you know. It's like, okay, no. Like I pick a simpler object, basically, that's not as overwhelming, and allow your attention to rest with that. And then you can kind of build up to the more complex, difficult ones. So with compassion, the ones that are harder, you know, in metta, I said there's sort of the mandala of of the one it's easy to wish metta for, and then neutral and so on. So they're kind of the same thing with compassion, right, too. But actually, oftentimes the one that it's easier to have compassion for is someone who you know but is not like the closest person to you. Because if it's the closest one to you, like your child or your spouse, then that's the one sometimes you're more attached to how it turns out for them. So it's easier to fall into despair or feel grief or something like that. So they can be like further down the line, actually. You know, they move down the lineup of difficulty. And likewise, you know, huger, you know, bigger things that you care about, like about war and environmental destruction and stuff like that. So that would not be the easy place to start. You know, I mean, it's good to get to that, but can consider that like later as you sort of build up your momentum of being able to connect with that. So it's kind of learning, you know, it's like if you're learning to walk or something, you know, you do it in simple circumstance first, you know, like on flat ground, and then maybe you can progress to like rocky ground, and then the hardest one is like sand or something. I saw a baby trying to walk on sand recently. It was like, they were okay in the parking lot, then they got to the sand, and it was like, you know, it was very difficult. And they were really surprised. Like, I think they had not been on sand before. It was like, what is this, you know? So, yeah, just recognizing even with the development of the mind and heart, like, it's like that, you know, there's some parts that are much harder. So, particularly with these heart practices, the recommendation is to start where it's easiest. Sometimes we don't trust that. It's like, no, we have to start where it's hard. But actually start where it's easiest. You know, it's like building a fire, too. Like, start with a little kindling, little spark, you know. Then as it gets larger, you throw the bigger logs on, right? So let us start small. Trust that. So we'll spend some time also doing this in walking. So as with the metta practice, it's good to practice it in meditative seated posture, but also it's really good to practice in motion to develop the ability to have the compassion while moving around in the world. So you can do this in a variety of ways. So one way is just in, as you're walking, you know, recognizing what you're seeing around, right? A little bit like I was describing, you know, as noticing things while driving and feeling a sense of compassion like that. A more concentrated way to do it is to work with then one particular object, one particular person or object, so kind of like what we did with the metta, where you walk with that image of that person in mind. Or also you could have, like we did with the metta, imagine that that person is at the end of the walking path and that you're wishing metta for the, compassion for them. The Pali word for that is karuna also. Can be wishing compassion for them as you walk towards them, and then turn around and then wish again as they appear on the other side, like that. So you can choose which one you want to do. If you want to have them in mind, like with the metta, so you could imagine walking with them, you know, hand in hand with them. So like you're saying this to them, a dear friend, or someone who you don't know but you care about their suffering. And if you notice yourself, you know, getting distracted by stuff around, I would say just bring the attention back and then just reconnect again. Sometimes you find yourself distracted, you can just stop in the middle of the walking path, allow yourself to reground in the body, you know, and then connect again. Right? So the compassion, you can keep it simple, like one phrase is fine, you know, if it's just, may you be free from suffering, or I care about your pain, or may you be free from anxiety. Or if you want to pick two is fine. Three is okay, but you don't need to make it much more complicated than that. So it's just, it really is like the devoted return to that, you know, again and again, to that, to the heart of compassion. So there's a lot of patience involved. It develops a sense of constancy, you could say. And yeah, just notice what comes up. You know, if there's a desire to turn away or boredom or, you know, all of that. It's like, keep coming back, keep coming back. So I thought I was done with the sports metaphors, but I think I'm not. So a little bit. So I was just reading something about an athlete, a coach who trained a lot of athletes for the Olympics, and you're saying really, you know, in a lot of physical training, there's long stretches of it that are actually just really boring, you know, that are not actually particularly interesting. And so what you're saying is, you know, who are the people who succeed or who excel in their sport? It's, you know, part of it may be sort of natural ability and build and things like that. But he said really what he saw, even among those people, was that the people who are willing to continue through the boredom, you know, who didn't stop even when it was boring. So basically who had this kind of determination or constancy or patience with it, you know, just... I keep coming back to this word of like devotion, you know, it's like a devotional practice and of the heart. So it's helpful if it can be done also, you know, with this sense of love. So not necessarily with the sense of like, I have to do this thing, but just understanding the benefits of developing the heart of compassion, you know, and in that way, just like coming back. Right? I mean, it's kind of true of developing anything, like any discipline or any practice, or, you know, it takes practice and it takes some devotion and things like that. So just encouragement of doing it in that spirit. So are the walking instructions clear? So we start with the compassion for someone who it's easier for us to wish well for. And in this mandala related to the development of compassion, where to place ourself can be an interesting exploration. So is it possible to have compassion for ourself? Is there such a thing as self-compassion? And there's somewhat of a semantic debate about this, whether that's actually taught or exists, and so on. It is possible to recognize the suffering that is there in your own experience, so of the physical body, of the mind, and then it is possible for compassion to arise in relationship to that. For most people, the relationship to oneself is one of full identification and attachment most of the time. So then it's easy to fall into a sense of grief or self-pity in contrast to actual sense of compassion. So in some ways, in order to access a response of compassion in regarding suffering that we ourselves experience, we actually have to shift the way that we see ourselves. And both the practice of compassion or metta does shift this, but in order to relate with compassion, we actually have to shift our identification with what is happening with ourselves in some way such that we can relate to it in the same way that we could to someone else's suffering. So this can be very hard to do. It's an unfamiliar thing for us. So we're usually clinging to our own experience in a very different way than when we see someone else, for example, with an injury or limping. It's difficult to relate in the same way to oneself when one has an injury. And you can notice the sense of like, but this is me now. You know, it's like, but this is my limp. Like, I have to be with this all the time now. This is a problem, you know. So I want to teach you one possible method of working with this, which is one of kind of going from the usual small way we relate to ourselves to a much more expansive way in which we might relate to all beings or a variety of beings. And even in Vipassana practice, I'd say in some ways we're trying to dislodge our fixation or our usual perspective that we have in ourselves, either by kind of going micro and seeing the micro moments of impermanence in what we usually consider a solid experience, but sometimes also by going kind of wide angle, we get the same shift of perspective that can help to dislodge our usual fixation and self-cherishing in some way. So it gives you an example of this with compassion that I think is the first way that that came to me, is like in dealing with a sense of loneliness, for example. So supposing that it comes up like a sense of loneliness, in some circumstance for you. And it's quite a common thing that might happen. And sometimes it happens when you're actually alone. Sometimes even when you're with a bunch of people, there could be a sense of loneliness, feeling not connected, something like that. So you can connect with that experience of loneliness, actually allow yourself to feel that, the sensations of that, the emotion of that. That in and of itself can be hard because many times we try and wriggle our way out of feeling discomfort, physical, emotional, you know, and distract ourselves, or, you know, you can notice yourself wriggling around, trying to not feel that. You can see if you can let yourself, you know, relax into, open to feel the sensations of that experience of loneliness. So know that loneliness, right? And then actually sometimes this sense of reflection can help too. And through this reflection, you can reflect like, okay, this is loneliness. This is this experience of loneliness right now. And actually, at the same time, there are probably many, many, many people in the world who are also experiencing the sense of loneliness. And you could even reflect on imagining, you know, what are some of these circumstances. So there could be someone who is old, who is in a home that no one is visiting them, you know, who's alone. There could be someone who is a little kid who no one is wanting to eat lunch with them at school, right, who's feeling lonely. There could be someone in prison who's feeling lonely. There could be someone who is a soldier sent off to a different place to fight in a war who's feeling lonely. There could be even someone in the very room who's feeling lonely that we don't know about. You know. So in some ways, as we reflect on that, we can recognize that loneliness is just one of the kaleidoscope of experience that human beings face. And suddenly we're actually part of the fellowship of loneliness, you know, like it's sort of like the kaleidoscope has shifted and this is the color that's being projected onto us now, but then we'll shift to something else, shift to something else. And we're not the only ones that are experiencing that at this moment, you know. So it's kind of dissolves the loneliness to recognize that we're part of a fellowship of loneliness. We're in the loneliness club at the moment, right? So you can then feel actually compassion for all of us, you know, having this experience. So the perception of separation, whether or not it's true, this sense of separation and the pain that comes from that is this experience right now, which is actually a very human experience, you know, a sense of loneliness. So like in this day, you know, if you're on your own with this, and you're working with it, you could feel it, but sometimes there's a sense of, like, it's hard to get out of it, because it's like, here's me, and I'm lonely, and I'm struggling with it, you know. But this is like, you know, it sends a tube down into this whole giant field of loneliness, of which you're a part, you know, it's like a way out. It's like digging a tunnel out of prison or something like that, you know. So through connecting to this wider field, then it can be easier to generate compassion, actually, for all of us who are in this state right now. And it doesn't have to be that complicated like that. And, you know, different people might have a easier or harder time imagining sort of others with this. But I think, you know, helping yourself to get out of your limited view of this is only happening to me can be really helpful. And this is true of anything that's happened to you. Basically, anything that's happening to you, someone else is experiencing that. People have experienced it in the past, and people will experience it in the future, right? So that includes, there's the fellowship of breakups. There's the fellowship of sprained ankles. Right? There's a fellowship of flat tires. Yeah, there's the fellowship of lost wallets. Yeah. There's a fellowship of just diagnosed with cancer. There's the fellowship of didn't get the job that I wanted. There's the fellowship of parents dying. There's the fellowship of toothaches, you know. So basically anything, you know, that we experience is actually also being experienced by others at this very moment, has been experienced by others in the past, will be experiencing in the future, right? So sometimes allowing ourselves to connect with that, you know, in a more wide-angle way can help us to access compassion for all beings, you know, because this is all part of samsara. This is all part of the inescapable vicissitudes of life. So we'll try this as a practice now. Can experiment with it, see how it goes.